Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening from wherever you're listening. Welcome to New Books in South Asia, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm your host, Ujan. In today's episode, I am speaking to Michael Dodson about his book, Bureaucracy, Belonging, and the City in North India, 1870 to 1930, published by Routledge in 2020. Professor Dodson teaches at the Department of History in Indiana University. He's currently the Academic Director of Indiana Gateway Office, New Delhi. Professor Dodson is also the author of Orientalism, Empire, and National Culture in India, 1770 to 1880, and has edited one of the most compelling and influential volumes on the urban history of Banaras, titled Banaras Urban Forms and Cultural Histories. Welcome, Professor Dodson, to our podcast today.
Thank you very much, Ujan. It's great to be with you.
Yes. So we always start with biographical questions. So if you could just start with how you came to work on Indian history in general, but this book in particular.
Right. Thank you. It's a kind of a complicated story. So I don't have your kind of typical exposure to South Asian history. I was, as an undergraduate, I did a philosophy degree kind of very interested in epistemology and worked on Bishop Berkeley and Descartes and David Hume and these kinds of figures. And being a philosophy major, you know, I had very few career prospects. And so spent much of my early 20s just traveling, working a little bit and then traveling. And in my early 20s, in the kind of mid-1990s or so, I found myself in Delhi, traveling around in North India, and really took to it in this way that surprised me, actually. So started to learn a little bit of Hindi and came back to Vancouver, where I was living at the time, and enrolled in a master's program. And serendipitously, when I started, you basically had the choice of doing Sanskrit or Hindi. You know, the year that I joined, it was Sanskrit, you know, because I didn't have enough Hindi for second year. And so I started as a Sanskritist, and which led me to eventually work on Sanskrit scholarship in the 19th century, which is the subject of my first book. So as a part of that book, I also spent a lot of time in Banaras, or Varanasi as it's now known, and over time became really intrigued by the city's history, really compelled by its various contradictions, and would spend days on end, for example, walking in the city, in the old city, and other parts of Banaras that are often like less traveled by tourists and visitors, comparing what was there to old maps and thinking about the evolution of the city over time, from the 19th century into the present. And it's really that drove me into abandoning really kind of cultural histories of religion and of language, which was what I started with, and to change And to work much more on the urban history of northern India, and you know, as you mentioned, in particular on Benares. So thinking about Benares as a space for the kind of colonial history that we do for many other places, that actually doesn't get done in Benares very much at all.
Right. So you did your PhD from Vancouver.
No. So actually, I did a master's degree at the University of British Columbia. And then it was a very fortuitous time to be doing it because really, in my first year, this Englishman came by to give a talk on his quite, you know, his recently published book, Empire and Information. And of course, that was Christopher Bailey. And we hit it off. And he said, you know, really, the kinds of project that you're doing, I'm very interested in doing it. I want to do this project, or I want to kind of see people working on the history of Sanskrit. And I have a colleague at Cambridge who's also very interested in this, Ivan Karsh. So why don't you come? And I was like, okay. So I did, and I went to Cambridge and did my PhD with Chris, and also under the with the additional help of a very talented Sanskritist, Ivan Karsh. And that was how I ended up there.
Wow. So now I have to read your first book too, because I am a Sanskritist by avocation, but never took it to academically yet. But now I have to read your first book too. And it's fascinating, the transition you mentioned from being a Sanskritist and primarily historians or philosopher of religion to writing urban history. So my first question then actually bounces off from this, and that's very interesting, is that the history of Benares historically is written particularly from Sanskrit sources, a strand of historiography, granted. But it is very dominant. And still continues to be dominant. In the last few years, the net number of books I've seen in Benares, in some way or the other, focuses on either the Puranas, the Kashikanda, the Sthala Mahatyas, or something or the other. And you, despite of your background as a Sanskritist, chose to not use those sources, and that I find very interesting.
Yes, so when you put it that way, it's kind of also a bit surprising because, of course, Sanskrit is what brought me to Benares in the first place. And, you know, I would spend every afternoon, for example, with my Vyakaran teacher, you know, my teacher of Sanskrit grammar, either at his home or, you know, in a classroom. And we would, you know, go through, you know, Panini's grammar, you know, for better or for worse. And you know, and perhaps that's what kind of eventually put me off Sanskrit. But you know, like Sanskrit was such an integral part of my first years in Benares. It was all about learning Sanskrit better, learning Sanskrit in the traditional way where you sit at the pundit's feet, where you recite and where you look at commentary. And that was how, you know, that was how that book in some ways was written, in the sense that I was using British sources primarily, and I was using sources that I found in Benares and Sanskrit. Primarily the work was all informed by this kind of relationship I had with my Sanskrit acharya, right? And this is, you know, it was like always thinking about how it had been done, always trying to recapture this moment of the kind of, let's say, the collision of those traditional ways of learning with the modern world, right? And to find that in Benares they had continued on in important ways, but also being changed. And I had this modern perspective that I was, you know, that I had been taught Sanskrit originally from a textbook, and yet suddenly I was learning it in this other way. And so that really kind of drove the book in a lot of ways. But then what I came to understand over time was, you know, not just that Benares was this historical place, this place with a long history, and a place that had a really prominent place in people's imaginations. But it was this place that had enormous infrastructural problems. It had enormous challenges. I lived in the city for most of the year 2000 while I was doing this work for this first book. We rarely had electricity. Our telephone worked like half the time, maybe, and not even then. The water, of course, is poisonous. And you just think about like how does the approach one brings to a city and thinking about it and writing about it inform our kind of partisanship for it in the present, right? And so I suppose that ultimately what I, the feeling that I developed over time, and this took me a little while, but was that if you're going to write about Benares as otherworldly, as a place beyond time, as a place that has just this kind of religious importance. And this is informed, of course, there's a passage in the most recent book, which I describe having a conversation with someone next to the Ganga, right? And it's this conversation that you've had a million times in Benares, maybe not about the Ganga, but about something else, which is that someone will come up to you feeling a little bit, confrontational and say, do you think this river is dirty? And you say, well, as you watch the bodies float by and the garbage, yeah, this river is really dirty. And we know that it's really dirty. It's septic, in fact. Things are unable to survive in this river. And yet there is this sense that, no, that's not true. This is a sacred place. It doesn't operate according to the normal strictures of physics and physical law, right? And one has to say, well, I respect your view on this. That is okay for you to think. But as a historian and as someone who grew up outside that particular faith, one can say, well, the writing that I do about this city is about its past, but it takes a view of the place not as otherworldly, not as dominantly religious, but as a city like any other. Because Benares, for all its specialness, is a city like any other.
So I would just, before I ask you to just summarize your argument, which is just a vague question, but we always ask our guests, but I would just ask this sort of bouncing off from what you said, that so there's a huge sort of romanticization or esotericization of Benares, even in academic discipline. And yes. And I think part of what I think has led, because of that esotericization and romanticization of a timeless Benares, is its infrastructural problems have gone unaddressed in academic scholarship, which is what I think your book really does so well to bring to forth, because I think Benares has been crying out for a book that talks about what's really going on in terms of its real material infrastructural problems and build space and so on. But what I want to ask you is, why do you think is there's such a strong tendency in academic scholarship to romanticize Benares, overlooking its sort of material problems?
Right. So, excuse me, this is what we call the city of light genre, of course, named after Diana X. Important and, really very interesting book, but one that really solidifies an approach to the city that has become so dominant, which is to look at it, as you said, through Sanskrit texts like Kashikanda, looking at it as a religious geography primarily. And so, when you spend time in Benares for any length of time, you run into anthropologists and geographers who are kind of mapping the city's religious spaces. And this is this is something you see in particular in a lot of German scholarship in the last couple of decades. And it's a very consistent kind of approach to the place. It's like, let us, and it's quite an enumerative approach very often as well. It's like, we will look for every single temple and we will map it, and we will map every single Shivalinga in this entire city. And then we will, it's this kind of drive for a complete knowledge. So without This is a slightly broad generalization, and it may annoy some people. But I think that it has its roots in a much older approach to Benares, which one sees in the British period, right? Which is to say that, you know, Benares is seen as exotic. It is described and painted and written about as exotic. We know from the 18th century forward that the Ghats and the temples become key sites for representing the city to Europeans. It's a site that also allows the British, in particular during the Company period and afterwards, to create these narratives of civilizational difference, right? One can say, look at this city. It is primarily religious and it is dirty. And thus, you know, Hindus are dirty, right? Or some ridiculous kind of construction like that. And that's how, of course, the colonial state works. It works by creating negative stereotypes, notions of one's inability to rule oneself. And so Benares becomes this kind of key site for that. That's accentuated even further by missionary discourse, which is very prominent in Benares. So Benares is one of the key sites for missionary activity from the early 19th century onwards, because there's this view that if, you know, this Brahminical stronghold of northern India, if it can fall to Christianity, then the whole country will, right? So Benares becomes like this fountainhead in some ways, highly symbolic of Hinduism and by extension, Indian civilization writ broadly. Right. It also becomes a site for kind of theorizing Islamic iconoclasm. Right. You know, of course, the famous mosque of Aurangzeb, the Darahara, which, again, is, you know, you can see the echoes of this in contemporary Benares speech as well, that, you know, this is a Hindu site. And, you know, Muslims are invaders or, you know, temple breakers. This all has its roots in the British period and in essentially in Orientalist descriptions of the city. And what's really strange, actually, is that if you go back even a little further, you go back to Jean-Baptiste Tavernier and his accounts of Benares, he's quite clear in the sense that, yes, this is a Hindu city with many, you know, pagodas, as he calls them, and many temples. But equally, this is a city with a very fine tradition of cloth making and silk making. He talks really a lot about the economic base of the city. So way back in the 1650s or 1640s or whenever he's there, I can't remember exactly. He talks about Benares as the space of economic, worldly activity, and the space of religious, otherworldly activity simultaneously. And somewhere between Tavernier and, say, the painter William Hodges, or, you know, the Mills, you know, in the 19th century, and, you know, many, many people beyond, we lose that recognition of this other aspect of the city. And it becomes a foil, in essence, becomes a stereotype in itself, a foil for British discourse about civilizational difference, a foil for talking about the strategies for improving Indian civilization, Indian culture, Indian society, whatever, through British intervention. This is a key site of colonial experimentation. And what I guess I don't understand ultimately is that, yes, on the one hand, we have a rich literature that talks about Benares's religious geography in Sanskrit texts, right? But on the other hand, we have a city that has been created in our imaginations through particular kinds of colonial strategies of disempowerment. Why are we still talking about Benares in this way, right? We can clearly recognize Benares as a place that holds both, right? That holds both a religious significance, but is much more than just that, And that's what this book tries to do, in essence.
Right. Yeah. And And I always think that in the end, a number of books that have been published on Banaras, let's say from in the last 20 years, it's really strange how dominant that religious geography, it's almost like an ideology now about in terms of it, how it influences writing on Banaras. And in my personal opinion, I would say this is something that spreads beyond Banaras in the sense we try to look most holy cities through the lens of religious geography, sort of negating the huge infrastructural histories, problems, material realities that they go through. So that's really something that I wish scholars take more cognizance of cities as and their material problems, even though that literature, of course, has its place because we know that there's enormous, that Banaras's religious history cannot be overlooked because of its huge importance it has had in the past, but it also has these other aspects, which is something your book does brilliantly. So I would add really quickly
that, you know, what we can clearly say is that, you know, the religious sentiments and practices and the social structures that are built up around religion in a city like Banaras, but also in many of the other religious cities, you know, or predominantly religious cities, you know, in South India or in Eastern India, as you work on, you know, this is not unimportant to analyzing infrastructural change, colonialism, you know, debates about the nature of the state. All of these things are intertwined. But where a problem is when you disengage religion from everything else, right? And treat it kind of on its own in this kind of vacuum.
Yeah. That's exactly what this is about. And of course, Banaras now, with the political climate now in India, we have Banaras sort of part of a new revival. Narendra Modi is now contests his elections from Banaras, goes, wears, you know, does all the Ganga Arati and everything. And it's sort of, I mean, I don't know how to say this, but I think that furthering and emphasizing more on Banaras as a timeless past of a Hindu city sort of has its problems, especially now, I think. I mean, 10 years ago, I wouldn't say that this was a problem, but now it seems like a bigger problem than it has always been.
And I think the interesting thing there is that, you know, clearly Modi and the BJP can trade on this notion of Varanasi as, you know, a Hindu stronghold, and the Vishwanath Corridor project that's being pursued there is, you know, is clearly an attempt to create, as I've written elsewhere on platform, this idea of kind of modern Hindu space, like an infrastructure for Hindu worship in a modern way. Right. But it's also it's interesting that, you know, Modi himself recognizes the infrastructural problems of Banaras and, you know, and the surrounding region as well. And so he's, you know, he has, you know, to whatever extent it's been successful, you know, talked a lot about the cleaning of the Ganga. Right. So he recognizes, you know, this is quite in kind of contrast to a lot of kind of mainstream Hindu rhetoric about the river, that, you know, he recognizes that it suffers from significant pollution. He recognizes that the city's electricity grid is subpar. You know, Banaras is now to be a smart city. You know, I'll look forward to seeing that. But, you know, it's not just this kind of trading on, you know, on this rhetoric of, you know, of the Hindu city, but recognizing that the Hindu city also exists, you know, in, you know, has infrastructural and technological needs, right? And these things need not be, you know, separated from one another. And, you know, this is not to, you know, endorse anything that he says or does, you know, or to, you know, necessarily to condemn it. But it's just an observation on my part that the place of Banaras in his rhetoric is a little bit more complicated and a little bit more surprising than I would have thought.
Yeah, that's interesting because for... I mean, one of the things, sort of this is sort of sidetracking, but just like I mean, I do not think, I just think that talking about Banaras would always go here, but I always think that, I mean, the essence of the Hindutva rhetoric at right now, or has always been, basically of their timeless past. And for them, the metonymy of that ideology, sometimes it appears to me, if there was ever a material metonymy for that, it would be Banaras. Like, look at our, this place, this has been timeless, it has been there forever. And it also furthers this narrative that in the middle there was a Islamic invasion, and look, we have this here in Banaras, they destroyed our city, but now we want to regain it back. So, and I think that, and this is my only sort of interesting, my not interesting, but I do find this very strange, that any place claiming that to be timeless is problematic. But for Banaras, it's like, it seems to me like a bit more problematic than any other city. So,
well, and you know, the British travel narratives of the 19th century and guidebooks used to warn against disappointment when you go to Banaras, because you are expecting an ancient city and what you come across is something that's like 20 years old. And of course, you know, when you think about some of, you know, the oldest sites in the city are, you know, are Buddhist, and to some extent they're Muslim, and there's some quite old Hindu spaces as well. But primarily, you know, 95% of the city is built in the last 200 years. And that's simply because, you know, like most cities are like that. You know, we're not, people in Banaras are not living in 1,000-year-old houses. So it's, you know, the city itself, certain kinds of narrative strategies have to be created about its otherworldliness to be able to explain its temporal character, right? And to emphasize the unseen as a really prominent part of Banaras, an unexplainable part of Banaras, or at least unexplainable through the typical means of science and technology. And that's really, I think, where, you know, one can recognize those narratives, one recognizes those discourses and say, you know, they have their place in the world, right? They're there historically, and they're there, you know, in the contemporary world. But that doesn't mean that in the 19th century, for example, as today, people in the city were not grappling with a whole variety of problems. They were fashioning the city to work for them so they can provide for their families, thinking about tax structures, thinking about infrastructures, and then also creating spaces for the future, right? Thinking about the futurity of the city as well. And this is very often, so these things go together. And again, as I've said, you know, the problem with the you know, the city of light genre of writing is that it takes a very limited source space and extrapolates it to the present in some way to say, this is what the city means. And what I've always tried to emphasize in my writing about Banaras is to say, listen, that's fine. Banaras means this, but it means an awful lot more too, right? And in some ways, these other things, I think, are, you know, they've been lost to us because they're not necessarily as exotic. It's not very exotic to talk about tax structures, right? But one might say that tax structures are, in fact, you know, as important as one's religious belief system, you know, when you're making a living in the 19th century city.
Yeah, and that sort of leads me to my next question, is the question on sources. So the sense I got from your book is your book delves in what I would like to say the catacombs of colonial archive. And it is so detailed. And I know so that it's, and I love the fact that the book is about everyday. Like, I get a sense of what's happening sort of in the everyday life of a small temporal part of 19th century Banaras. And so I would imagine writing on Banaras based on religious sources also has to do a lot with availability, because, you know, these are available sources, well-preserved. And I read that part where you talked about the archive not being preserved well. And there was a flood in Gomati and half of the things got wasted, which is the case with so many municipal archives. And I weep thinking the things we have lost. But you still are able to recover some aspects of it. And your book is surprisingly rich in the archival sources it brings to forth. I was fascinated while I was reading it, and every time I was going back to the end notes to see where these sources are, and it seems to be like an extremely what I'm sort of getting at is, how would you characterize your approach to the historical archive for a city like Benares, and to write its history from the archive that's generally sort of either being dilapidated physically or intellectually, where historians don't pay enough attention to it?
Right. Well, kind of one of the core arguments of the book is that we can get at the everyday through the mode of the transaction, right? And that that the colonial state is highly transactional, and that it engages with Indians at an everyday level all the time, right? Through its various bureaucracies. And so one of the things that I've always wanted to try to impress on my books and on myself and on, you know, my students, is that the colonial state's not a monolith, right? We can, you know, there is a way of talking about the colonial state, you know, that one can characterize it as extractive, right? Yes, it's extractive. Is it evil? Well, you know, yeah, often it's really evil. Is it something to be replicated, you know, in the present day? No. You know, it's a lot of negative things. And this kind of goes back to my Bailey training and, you know, the old debates about, you know, between Cambridge School and Chicago School. It's about the power of the state to authorize narratives, to authorize, to create knowledge about place and about people. And the argument here is that the colonial state, actually, at below the level of its rhetoric, is a very complex set of interweaving machines that are populated by people, some of whom are good, some of whom are less good, some of whom are competent, some of whom are less competent, some of whom are Indian, some of whom are not. And all of these moving parts create these spaces for the articulation of needs, desires, visions of the present, interpretations of the past, hopes for the future, right? So one of the ways that, you know, we can get at these, you know, if you want to just write a history of the colonial state, that's fine. That's not my gig, really. What I'm interested in doing is writing a history of how people engage with the colonial state in a city like Benares, and through that engagement, create spaces for themselves, right? And create spaces in which they can envision their own futures, and also articulate these ideas about the past that mean something to them in a way that the colonial state may or may not recognize. So, you know, as I've said, we could go to, like, you know, the novels of Premchand, we could go to oral histories. And this is one way of getting to, you know, to that other Benares, right? And that's kind of, I did some of that in my first book. But here what I thought is, like, let's go to the archives themselves, the archives created by the colonial state, and really dig to this really local level and see what kinds of Indian voices emerge from the remnants of these transactions, right? And so there are, as you know, there are multiple levels of archival collections in India and in Britain. So, you know, A proceedings and B proceedings and C proceedings and all this kind of stuff. So a lot of, actually, we're lucky in the sense that in London, we have, in the municipal proceedings, still the evidence of a lot of the you know, the discussions of the municipality in Benares, which includes, you know, them writing to the commissioner writing back to them writing between themselves. It's a really rich archive that goes down to a very local level, you know, with the functioning of the municipal board in a place like Benares itself, right? And that's really good because those municipal archives don't exist any longer in Benares.
This is in London. It's preserved in London.
Yes, that's so. Oh, wow. Those are municipal proceedings in the British Library, right? Okay. So they're, you know, for this, it's Northwestern Provinces/United Provinces, and there's also what's called the self-government proceedings, which look at basically local self-government from a more policy oriented position, and that's more about how, because that's as we know, in the period post 1857, while we have the reiteration of a kind of strong center and an aggressive colonial state, by the 1860s and by the 1870s, the actual work of governance is being devolved quite significantly to provincial level and then also to the municipal level. This is happening, obviously, not only in cities like Calcutta, but it's happening in Allahabad, it's happening by the 1880s in Benares, by the 1890s in Jaunpur and Chunar, Mirzapur, all over these little Mufassil towns as well. So that stuff is all in the British Library, and we're quite lucky to have it, as I said, because for the most part, in the municipal records from the 19th century no longer exist. Right, I can remember Francis Robinson telling me years ago when I asked him about his work in Jaunpur in the 1970s. He said, "Oh yeah, we had all those municipal archives, all that municipal stuff, and he says it's gone now. They burned it. It's all gone." And the same is true in Benares. There might be some stuff, but no one knows where it is. So it's as good as lost. So. But what you also find what I find really the richest source base for a project like this is in the regional archives of Uttar Pradesh. And so there is one in Benares itself. And these are the records of the commissioner's office, the magistrate. And again, we have lots of municipal stuff that finds its way into there, lots of the day-to-day. It really is a very finely grained archive. But it's also partial. It's also contingent. As I write in the book, I ordered up this one file that said, Georgian tomb, because I was looking for the tomb of Cornwallis, which is a lovely place in Ghazipur. Really interesting structure. I was just kind of randomly interested in how it managed to end up there. And what you get instead is hundreds of pages of stuff about archaeological mounds and Aurangzeb's mosque. So great. other times it's just not there at all. So, but that's something we have to reckon with, which is, the fact that, India remains, a country that, that doesn't or is unable to invest in its archives in quite the same way that a place like the British Library can. And so, one has to be cognizant of this. And, it's not to damn the government of Uttar Pradesh. They do the best that they can. But it also means that, like, over time, these records have become they become collated, they become kind of reorganized, things get lost, things disintegrate. And the challenge for us is to say, okay, let's not just whine about it, because there's not much point in whining about it, but what can you do with what you have? And for me, it's always been the challenge to try to use a state archive to get at people, right? And to understand how some of the most cherished, the most cherished prerogatives and aims of the colonial state are undermined from within, both on the one hand by the kind of incompetence of the bureaucracy of the colonial state, which is kind of an interesting argument, but also how Indians themselves just sometimes say, no, that's not what this is, and we're not listening to you anymore. So, and you do find these glimpses, and you think, so part of the challenge of writing a book like this is then to say, if this is what we have, imagine what else we don't have. And imagine then what the colonial state really was. And this is not to say that it wasn't extractive or exploitative. It was. I'm not Niall Ferguson. I am not an apologist for empire in any way, shape, or form. Right? And I don't ever want to be read that way. But what this gives us insight into is the limits, the epistemological limits on the one hand, but also the real physical limits of the colonial state to impose its vision on India. And that's, you know, that's the vision that is, in a particular, in a place like Benares, is so worth trying to excavate, because it shows us what else Benares is.
Right. Yeah, that's wonderfully put. And before I ask you a bit about Jaunpur, I just want to just emphasize that in so much, I have seen, like, in most places, I have seen the, and at least in Puri, I have seen that the colonial state is acts almost as vulnerable as it is in Benares in some cases. Mm-hmm. And it is almost in places in, like, putting in legislation, taxation, in matters of that, it's constantly negotiating mm-hmm. With this idea that we have, the colonial state had a vision that it could possibly impose, is a lot more complex than what it seems. And I have seen, when you go to the archive, even though it is supposed to document the powers of colonial state, it gives a very different idea about what the colonial state was. Mm-hmm.
And that complexity is a wonderful complexity, really, for a historian to engage with, right? But it has, of course, these great ideological pitfalls
that you must
be careful to avoid.
Yeah. But I would like to ask you this then. It's sort of like reorienting your same question about sources and writing urban history. In the last few years, we have a lot of works on urban history, but a lot of said works focus on using sources like the built space, histories of architecture, looking at the city through novels, which is something that sort of a literary analysis, which is very popular now. So my question is, where do you see the future of urban history now? Because very few urban historians tend to think it productive to go to the archive, the colonial archive, to write the history of urban space. And I was just hoping to ask you, what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, it's a great and difficult question simultaneously, right? So actually, I had my last, you know, I was teaching graduate students yesterday, and in our seminar on urban history, and we talked a lot about this as well. And you know, it strikes me, of course, that while India's past was predominantly rural, India's future is predominantly urban. And, you know, and India will, of course, possess the largest, the largest cities in the world by 2050. You know, Bangladesh and Pakistan, of course, also will have these, you know, these top five cities. Urban history, I think, has become just far more vibrant in the last decade or so, far more, almost kind of immediate and crucial and kind of really important, because we understand that we are hurtling towards this future of the ecumenopolis, I suppose, if you want to use Doxiadis, this idea of the world city, that the world will be predominantly urban. And so it's always this question of, like, what constitutes a city? In the end, we go round and round on this. Is it the buildings? Is it the people? Is it the people in the buildings? Is it the people and the buildings? Is it policy? Is it planning? And, you know, I think there's space for all of these kinds of approaches. I'm not terribly intrigued in these kinds of histories of architecture that are descriptive, and kind of take the view of, like, well, the star architect or the brilliant man, and his vision, you know, for this building, or indeed, you know, the brilliant man, and it's always a man, of course, and his vision for the city, right? It seems to me that we have actually an ethical duty to understand cities not as planned but as lived, and how people experience the city and how people engage with the economic and political and social structures of the city. Because at least part of our, I think, you know, and this is, again, something that's touched on a little bit in the book, but something I've become far more committed to over, you know, over the course of my career is that as historians, we're not antiquarians. We're not just writing about the past, but actually that we owe something to the places we write about and to the people that live in them, and to think of our scholarship as a form of advocacy for the cities we write about. And in order to do that, we need to understand them not as imagined, but actually how they were lived. And in a place like Benares, I think that the vitality of its local cultures, of its syncretism, of its, some kinds of unruliness, right? And its multiple legibilities, right? It is a very complicated place. And there's a great joy in that, but it's also a place that is so troubled by communal politics. It's a place that's so troubled by poverty and a lack of access to clean water, even today, that you can't just think about Benares as big party, right? You know, I'm so excited by it, but rather to keep all of these things in mind simultaneously. So I think actually the future of urban history in some ways is going to be engaging more directly in forms of advocacy, that's a hard one for me today for some reason, on the part of the city and the people who live there, right? There's a line in the book which I really enjoy when I come back to it quite a bit, and it's from Lewis Mumford, and it's this idea that you write about the cities that you he writes about the cities that he cares about, in this history, right? And I often think that actually we write history in order to care about a city, right? It's kind of the opposite way. Like when we write about a city, we come to know it. We come to know its challenges, its triumphs, how it's been built and evolved through the people that live there. And it's in writing this history that we really gain an appreciation for place and how we learn to love place. As I always say, I'm a partisan of Benares. I really enjoy the city. I have many friends there, and I care deeply about it. And I came to that depth of care for it by writing about it.
Yeah. Wow. So a part of your book is also about Jaunpur. And could you tell us a bit more about your selection of Jaunpur as a place in juxtaposition with Benares?
So there are two parts to the book, right? And, yeah. Again, the general idea is thinking about how, on the one hand, the colonial state cultivates different kinds of urban landscapes as meaningful spaces. And then how, on the other hand, through the workings of bureaucracy and legal and economic structures, Indians engage and undermine and create their own ideas of urban belonging and the meaning of space, right? So it's to see the creation of meaning in a direct engagement between the colonial state and its Indian subjects. So in the first half, it's Benares, and it's about the technoscape, right? This idea that, the engrafting of forms of water and sanitation technology into Benares, and how that is read by local residents, because by the colonial state, it's read as a mode of Indian improvement. And it's read in actually quite distinctive and interesting ways by the Indians who live there. For the second half, it's about the cultivation of historical landscapes. And part of why it moves to Jaunpur is that despite the fact that Benares is such an old city, its historical landscape is actually quite limited. And so we know in the 19th century that various archaeological surveyors and directors general of the archaeological survey, they come to Benares in the 19th and in the early 20th century, and they're kind of confounded by the place. And they don't really engage with it as a part of that historical landscape that the archaeological surveyors are creating. In the early 20th century in particular, Benares kind of escapes their grasp. And so I thought, what better play. And actually, you know, it was led to Jaunpur originally because Lord Curzon, the viceroy, 1899 to 1905, goes to Jaunpur and engages in a really meaningful way with the the medieval architecture of the Sharqi dynasty, which is an Indo-Muslim dynasty, in this place, and creates a series of local committees to help to preserve this landscape that he sees as quite important what Curzon does in essence is he's interested in creating a landscape that one could say that's Indian history, but also this is a landscape that's cultivated and maintained by a forward-looking and benevolent colonial state, right? So also Jaunpur is in itself just, it's kind of like this interesting counterpoint to Banaras in the sense that it's only a couple hours drive away. You know, it's also an ancient city. It existed as a small village before it was founded by a Firuz Shah Tughlaq, and it's a religious city in the sense it's often, you know, it was often in the 15th and the 16th century seen as a Shirazi Hind, this kind of center for Islamic learning and culture. But it's also about as different from Banaras as you can imagine, in the sense that it's never really grown particularly large. It's still quite underdeveloped, and it's in a way a city that had a quite different trajectory from Banaras. It's not on the tourist trail. There's not a lot of capital investment. Most of the city is still largely unmodernized. So I kind of thought it would make it. It also kind of demonstrates to us that in the 19th and the early part of the 20th century, colonial interventions in these cities, in fact, had real implications for the trajectories of these places, right? Jaunpur remains a city of the past in the way that the colonial state perhaps envisioned it, where Banaras is not, right? So, and for those of you listening who've never been to Jaunpur, I highly recommend it. It's a beautiful, beautiful small city with an incredibly rich architectural heritage.
So one thing that in the Jaunpur section of the book, one thing that struck me was Curzon's interest in pre-Mughal architecture, which is something we don't hear a lot about because we know Curzon's an imperialist. He does everything for his Taj Mahal. He electrifies the Taj Mahal. He builds the Victoria Memorial. He wants the empire to leave its traces long after the empire's gone. But what I see in your book is that he also has sort of a genuine interest in things that do not necessarily fit his larger cultural project, imperial project at least. And he's very interested in the Shi mosque and a dynasty that ruled before. And you make a very compelling case that he actually read James Ferguson, which is may or may not have inspired him. So can you tell me a bit about that?
So I'm pretty sure, so the name of the chapter is, you know, I think Curzon tours Jaunpur, James Ferguson in hand. And, you know, I'm sure that it's clear to me that he did read him. He kind of plagiarizes him in a number of spots, right? As do many others. So it's not like, it's not like we can necessarily fault him for that. We can fault him for lots of other things instead. So I think, Curzon's best remembered as this arch imperialist. And one of the reasons actually that we start with him wandering around in Jaunpur is because, you know, I want to make the point, first of all, that, he is interested in these more regional forms of architecture, and he writes quite significantly about them. He is the kind of colonial surveyor par excellence, right? And so he visits this city and says, you know, no one's taking care of these mosques, these magnificent medieval mosques. So let's create some local committees, and they're going to report to the collector and to the commissioner, and we're going to get this done. And off he goes, right, never to visit again. But I think that in a way, he's also, he never says this directly, but the Sharqi dynasty is a really heterogeneous dynasty with but with very deep local roots. The Sharkies are ostensibly foreigners, you know, in significant ways. You know, they are Shia, they are Habshis, they are eunuchs, and yet they create a really stable dynasty that flourishes. Now, it doesn't flourish for a particularly long period of time, but only for about 80 years. But it is an example of how a political dynasty can become really locally entrenched and kind of grow these deep local roots. And so he looks at the architecture and says, you know, this is quite clearly syncretic architecture. This is architecture that combines the best of the Hindu and the Muslim world together, right? We have the true arch, but also we have, you know, these very beautiful kind of floral patterns that are carved into the side of Jaunpuri mosques. And so I think in some sense he sees a model here for the British in some way, that which is to say that yes, this is still an empire, it's an expansive empire, and the Mughals are our best example of this, but also we can say that through the Sharki dynasty, through our conservation of the material culture of the Sharki dynasty, that we're also participating in that syncretism and those local roots, right? Kind of putting down our roots in this place also, right? So he will go on, you know, it's a very strange moment because, of course, several months later, he puts into place Act 7 of 1904, which is the Ancient Monuments Preservation Act, which in a really significant fashion, and again, this is, I think, part and parcel of Curzon, which is that it tries to centralize oversight of the preservation of India's architectural and archaeological heritage, right? And still today, as you know, as I'm sure you know, or if you, whenever you go to anything, there's that, you know, there's that sign out front that says, you know, under the care and control of, you know, the Archaeological Survey, it's a protected monument. So what I wanted to show, in essence, was that in Jaunpur, at least, this attempt to centralize oversight, to create this bureaucracy at the level of the imperial center that oversees monuments and narrates them, right? Narrates their meaning and also creates the sense of the colonial state as caretaker, is significantly undermined by the fact that at the local level, this level that Curzon seemed actually quite concerned about, all manners of negotiations and transactions and, you know, all sorts of interesting kinds of things happen, right? Which means that Jaunpur's mosques don't enter into Curzon's, you know, kind of the Curzon authorized narrative of what these spaces and these structures should be, right, as emblems of the British state in some way. But rather, they remain very closely tied to local politics, local cultural sensibilities, even in some cases to personal family narratives, right? So that's, I think, why Jaunpur is such a good example, and also because it has, you know, I was very lucky in the regional archives in Varanasi to happen upon a lot of documentation on this, committees, this oversight committee that Curzon had put into place, which was in the charge of Nawab Abdul Majid, who's a local landowner in Jaunpur. And so we have like this great information about what these guys are doing, what they're thinking, you know, how they're engaging with their, you know, with the mosques of the city, with the other structure, with the other ancient structures of the city, in a way that, you know, if we just read the proceedings of the archaeological survey, we would never know about. So it's this hidden history, which fortuitously, you know, is preserved. And, you know, so that's, you know, you get to tell a very different story about Curzon's visit to Jaunpur than you would if you only read this other kind of authorized archive.
Yeah, right. And yeah, I think we should wrap up. I don't want to keep you longer than promised. It's going to be an hour. But before we wrap up, I have two questions in the end. But I just want to ask you one thing for a very short response, which is your description of when the government wants to preserve the mosque. there's local resistance. But in the beginning of the book, you write a word that stuck with me, is that you don't want to categorize something as resistance, but as unconduct, which is your draw from Foucault.
Yeah, counterconduct.
And,
yeah.
Counterconduct. Yes. Sorry. And that word stuck with me because we generally see a lot of things as resistance, and I just wanted your thoughts on counterconduct versus resistance and how you see the
Well, you know, I think there are you know, this no question that during the colonial era, you know, Indians resist the colonial state, right? I don't, you know, and I don't mean to undermine that notion at all. But I think in the everyday, you know, there's, you know, so the book starts with this description of a riot, which is, you know, clearly resistance to the imperatives of the colonial state. People are rioting in Benares because they are concerned that this temple that they hold dear is being undermined by the public works department and is going to collapse. In fact, the, you know, it's clear from correspondence that that's exactly what the public works department intended to happen, so they can make way for this water infrastructure project. So that's clearly a form of resistance. But what happens after that form of resistance, right? There is this kind of, you know, in the everyday machinations of this, of the colonial state, it is coming into contact with people who are not necessarily taking up arms or resorting to violence to get their point across, but are making these small claims, right? Which are forms, I think, of this counterconduct. And I'm reluctant to focus too much on the spectacles of violence. And because, you know, while important, I think in a city like Benares and in many other contexts, I'm sure, it is this accumulation of this, of these gradual modes of saying no, or of saying, that's not how I understand it, or maybe turning one's back on the colonial state and saying, no, I'm not going to accept your money to preserve this monument. I'm going to do it myself, right? And so the example, I think, that best encapsulates this is actually this notion of whitewash, right? So the Archaeological Survey of India is obsessed, positively obsessed with removing whitewash from all architectural heritage, right? All of these older mosques and these older tombs, because they see it as a form of vandalism. It obscures part, you know, the details of carving, and it doesn't fit with their narrative of these places as being in the past, in essence, right? And so I make the argument that whitewash is actually this form of counterconduct, right? It's a different kind of taking care. When a local group decides to whitewash a building, they're saying, we're taking care of it. You may not recognize it as vandalism, but in fact, we've spent our money, we're whitewashing this building, we're sealing it, we're taking care of it, and we're using it, and it's not yours to determine what that means, right? And I think we can get to those narratives, right? We can tell a very different story about urban space and its meaning in the colonial period. And so that's, you know, that's why I focus on that idea. This, again, those small acts of the everyday, which I think do add up over time to something real and substantial.
Right. Yeah. So last two questions. The penultimate is something that we have all discussed, but just for our listeners, if you had to summarize what your book is about, what if in I know it's such like an elevator pitch graduate student thing to say, and hey, what's your research on? But yeah, if you could just for like in a sentence or two or three, just what this book encapsulates.
So it is on the one hand about how the colonial state through its bureaucracies attempts to create narratives about North Indian urbanism. And on the other hand, it is about how Indians engage through that bureaucracy with those narratives and create their own. And through doing that, create forms of belonging and partisanship on the part of their cities to, in essence, lay claim to them and undermine the notion of the colonial state as the ultimate arbiter of meaning and the ultimate caretaker of India.
Right. So I guess that is it. Last question before we let you go is what are you presently working on? Are you going to build up on working on Benares or?
No, I thought I would take a little Benares break actually, you know, having written about bananas for, you know, for nearly 20 years now. So right now I'm working on actually, you mentioned at the beginning, I'm the academic director for Indiana University's office in New Delhi. And so this is kind of, you know, something I've been doing for the last few years. And so I spend a lot of time in Delhi. And so I've been working recently on the modern architecture of Delhi. And so I'm writing a book now, which, I don't know what it's going to be called exactly, but it's about Delhi between 1947 and, let's say, 1991, beginning of liberalization, and about the city's planning, its growth, and about some of its architects and designers. So I've been working with Raj Rewal, you know, quite a well-known architect in the city, Kuldeep Singh, who designed the New Delhi Municipal Corporation buildings, and who died last year, unfortunately, from COVID, and a number of others, Mahendra Raj, who is an important concrete engineer, and thinking about how Delhi, you know, often, actually, you know, we don't, you know, what histories of Delhi are kind of so often end, you know, in 1947. And I'm interested to see how Delhi is created as a modern space and how, you know, on the one hand, it's, you know, I'm interested in governments and architects and the creation of these spaces, the planning of Delhi, you know, or you know, or the failure of planning in Delhi, perhaps. But then on the other hand, how people work in the city, how people move about it, and the nature of life in Delhi in the 60s and the 70s. So it stems from my failed early career in architecture, I suppose, and my love of concrete buildings. So I'm just kind of indulging, I guess my failed architect side for a little while, and trying to write actually a history of architecture that's not descriptions of architecture, but thinking about buildings as becoming there, you know, as I, you know, very quickly, New Delhi, of course, is always created as a space apart from Delhi itself. And then after 1947, Nehru and the government have to create a city that can actually support a much more extensive federal government. And so it's the looking at that process and looking at it both from the point of view of the government and what it wants to do, but then also looking at it kind of more from the ground level, from the ground up, so to speak, how one works in new office buildings, what these new office buildings mean, how one builds as well. So should be out in a couple of years, I hope.
Well, all the best. And thank you for being here with us today.
Thank you very much, Ujan. I really appreciate the time.